Hi again and welcome back to episode 4 of Kulturdenken, Thinking Culture, the podcast of the International Research Center for Cultural Studies at the University of Art and Design in Linz. We are in Vienna at the symposium titled OLFAC, Sensing Across the Humanities, Science and Arts. And I will speak with Gwen L. Lin. Gwen is a Franco-American transdisciplinary artist and activist. He builds interactive installations that combine sense, sound and technology to pose questions about identity, culture and the political. Gwen also performs with scents, sounds and teas. Lately, he has been exploring the space between environmental activism and art. Together with Deborah Riley Parr, he is the editor of the book Olfactory Art and the Political in an Age of Resistance, which is bringing together important voices of the olfactory research, among others, Sean Chu and Dorothy King, whom we hear in this podcast. Here at the OLFAC Symposium, Gwen Lin is presenting his ongoing research project called Contested Space. Speaking to Gwen after his presentation, here is how he describes his work.
So here is the premises of the project. As an activist, not so much as an artist, but as an activist, I've done a lot of work against infrastructures that provoke climate change, that contribute to climate change. And I kind of feel like, you know, over the past 10 years, there were moments where I was hopeful, and especially with the re-election of Donald Trump, I'm kind of like, well, however amount of the carbon dioxide is locked into the atmosphere, this is where we are. It's basically, it's too late. That's my personal position. And so learning about space junk, which is a different problem, but follows the same logic, extractive logic, I was like, we can do something about it now. It's not too late. It's not after the fact. It's happening now. We could still attempt to prevent it from getting worse.
Gwen has started his presentation with showing the sheer amount of old and new satellites, rocket pieces, and other bits of human-made trash circling around the Earth.
Space currently is being colonized and has been colonized since the dawn of the space age. So this notion of going to the new frontier is another word for wilderness, untamed. So Kennedy kind of looked at space, outer space, as the new frontier. This is where Americans will turn to send pioneers to colonize space. One of the consequences of that approach on Earth is climate change. So in space, they have the same approach. They've already polluted the moon.
Looking into how he can help to raise awareness of this process of the colonization of space, Gwen has been given a grant and went to field research in South Texas, where SpaceX, Elon Musk's private aerospace and space transportation company, has a rocket launch pad.
Then I figured, well, what can I do? So one of the ideas I had was to go at one of the locations that contributes to space junk, so SpaceX in South Texas. And I was hoping that I would meet enough activists, there would be enough of us basically to make a public piece of art. And I was thinking that we could pause those launches, those rocket launches, if there's an artwork there, because if they do the launch, then it would destroy it. But then I found out that actually there's not enough of us to do it. So I had to hold back on that idea. So instead, I decided to research where this is happening. And this is how I found out that it was in the middle of a state park, meaning it's supposedly protected. Then somehow Elon Musk and SpaceX have been able to circumvent that.
Here is Gwen during his presentation where he describes how the landscape looks.
So this is, again, natural preserves. So it's very flat because it's, where the fresh water from the Rio Grande meets the salt water from the sea. There's no trees. And what the photos don't convey is that it's extremely hot, very, very, very humid. So it's mosquitoes are very happy. But there's also birds, as you can maybe make out here. And it's also very wet, because there's, again, all that water that just seeps in. If there's a storm, there's even more water. So nothing else but these different types of grasses grow. But there are also species. So there's turtles, wild rabbits, deers. It's also a bird refuge. This is a hawk. And here's a shot of croton, which grows on the dune by the sea all along the Gulf of Mexico. And this is the camphor weed, which is not related to camphor from Asia, but has the same olfactory molecule.
This watery, swampy nature is highly at risk, as SpaceX is now building on this.
Starbase, which is where they manufacture the rockets, has become a city. So now you have a city, a small town, in the middle of a wilderness preserve, which means they're going to pour concrete, build a supermarket, all of that, in the middle of what was once an area set aside for wildlife. There's one road that goes from the city of Brownsville, which is a few miles, so a few kilometers behind inland. That's where they shoot their rockets. But then there's another compound where they make the rocket. So it's in at least two locations that are very close. But now all of that has the status of a city, which means they're going to keep building. So people that work at SpaceX don't have to commute, so they live right there.
The area is one of the most southern parts of the United States, around the city of Brownsville, which is the southernmost city in the United States, located on the border to Mexico. The county where Brownsville is located is one of the poorest counties in the U.S. I am asking about the pre-SpaceX community's background.
So the city of Brownsville at Port Isabel, it's mostly blue-collar, so working class, or what's left of the working class. So there's a ethnic dimension in the sense that all the people that work for SpaceX are, you know, highly qualified workers. And then the cities, the two cities that are nearby, are mostly blue-collar, lots of unemployment, lack of education. And so one of the ways Elon Musk is able to trap them in convincing them that this is good for you, even though it's not, is that it's going to provide jobs. But he doesn't, because the jobs are too qualified for the people who live there. So it's just, you know, he's basically brainwashing them. So you probably heard in the news about DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. When Trump was first elected, he nominated Elon Musk to make the government, the federal government, more efficient. But that was a cover-up for Elon Musk to get all the permits.
Every time SpaceX tests one of their rockets, it's using tons of liquid methane as fuel. If the launches go wrong, the methane blows up.
More than half of these launches fail and result in explosion. Debris falls out and puts the nearby communities at risk of physical hazard. In addition, SpaceX privatizes Boca Chica, public beach, for their own galas and the spectacle of their rocket launches. More importantly, this is also the ancestral land of the Stugna tribe. Their origin myth takes place on nearby South Padres Island, and burial grounds dot the landscape. Elon Musk can be heard at a press conference saying that he chose this land for his company because, quote, nobody lives there, end quote. And if a test rocket explodes, quote, it's cool, end quote.
Nobody lives there, and if rockets explode, it's cool. This way of making business is protected by the Trump administration. Gwen is stating the question why we have to go to space at all. Not only will we be littering the moon and the Mars, like we have been doing with Earth, and sooner or later destroy it, we will also be deprived of our senses. Gwen elaborates on that in his presentation.
Vision is the only sense that humans can use in outer space. It's impossible to use our remaining senses as there is no medium for us to survive in space, and this absence of medium also precludes stimuli to reach us. Cross-modal perception is impossible in space, and this fact should make us pause, as it is easy to understand that a sensory reduction at once reinforces visual hegemony and conduces neocolonialists to appropriate space for their own benefit. This sensory deprivation gives them the excuse to deploy colonial visual technology in order to conquer space, to privatize it for their personal goals. Yet, space belongs to no one. What Musk is doing in South Texas is land grab, good old land grab. He's gnawing at the natural preserves a little bit at a time with, of course, the complicity of the corrupt state of Texas. What this land grab manifests, along with the narrative that it is undeveloped land and that no one lives there, is that spatial colonization begins here on Earth before satellites or other instruments reach orbit. Hence, if we want to protect low Earth orbit from space junk, if we want to resist bringing the Anthropocene to the moon and Mars, we need to decolonize South Texas and other regions where there are rocket launch pads. Space decolonization begins here on Earth, and what better way to do this than ensure that the sensorium remains diverse and stimulates more than just the eyes? If we respect soundscape and olfactory scape and do not let them be colonized by methane and explosion noise, if we are still able to hear birds and smell camphor or croton or other plants, then we will pause and ask ourselves, why are we letting a handful of billionaires pollute near-Earth orbits in our name and their space junk? If we ask ourselves, what is the sensory benefit of having to wear a spacesuit that cuts us off from our sensorium, then why do we need to colonize the moon and Mars? Why would we sensory deprive ourselves? The colonial narrative at play to justify the commodification of space is nefarious. It will result in our species living in a sensory-deprived environment that is provided we survive the climate catastrophe we have unleashed. We need international standards to preserve our sensorium and therefore the land we inhabit in nearby space. There is something fundamentally inhuman in wanting to go to space. It's not meant for us, and it diminishes our sensory abilities. Hence, unless we embrace a techno-fascist approach, there is no reason for humans to even go to space. My intent is to find ways of decolonizing space. This process starts here on Earth. We have to find ways of pausing the rocket launches. Then we can collectively ask our species, is there any benefit in commodifying outer space? If the answer is no, we need an international framework that prevents the commodification of space and does not let a tiny handful of capitalists wreck vast expanses of the commons for their personal benefits. Meanwhile, artists and activists can resist this sensory-depriving agenda by ensuring that our sensorium remains in tune with our world atmosphere. More art that fosters olfaction and the other senses of proximity is becoming a necessity to ensure our survival.
I'm asking, Gwen, can olfactory art be an act of resistance?
I think that, so to me, if I kind of make this grand arc, watching a play or a choreography from the seat, on the proscenium, in the room, in the audience, it's kind of like watching TV. You're just being very passive. You're consuming this event that's happening in front of you. Regardless of, even if it's a Bertolt Brecht play, for example, that's supposed to be very political, you're still just watching it. There are other forms of theater or performance where you interact, and that compels us to become active, I think. So in other words, you participate in that performance, and then you're going to take that elsewhere, for example, at a protest, and you're going to be active. So I think it compels us to be active, and I think olfaction, the sense of olfaction for that is very efficient because you're actively smelling. The dominant smell in South Texas is not camphor or croton. It's the smell of standing water, so like water that has been stagnant, so it kind of stinks. But then there's all these other smells, but these smells, you actually have to search for them. So like the camphor, you have to get really close to it. I always, when I'm in nature, I always rub things to see if it releases a smell. You know, I activate things. I take the risk of maybe I'm going to be, stung by some plant and I'm going to have a rash, but that's fine. I just kind of try to, activate the smell, basically. So olfaction compels you to be active and therefore not passive. And so I think politically it's important.
Gwen is saying that on Earth, one can do more than simply gaze at a landscape. One can investigate olfactoryscape, soundscape, and these investigations can lead to empathy. This idea has been developed by Dorothy King. In her essay, Is There Empathy Through Breathing?, in Gwen's book Olfactory Art and the Political in an Age of Resistance, Dorothy is proposing the idea that olfactory perception is likely to trigger emotional responses. In this episode, I also want to speak with Dorothy King. Dorothy's topic at the conference somehow just connects very well to Gwen's presentation. As we now go from the macro perspective to the micro perspective, from space to a very small country in the European mountains. Dorothy King is professor and head of the Institute for Arts and Design Education at the University of Arts and Design in Basel, Switzerland. Her most recent publication is the Kleine Basler Designgeschichte, co-authored with Jonathan Adler and Ernst Merritt. Here is Dorothy's introduction to her presentation that connects her topic very well with what we just heard from Gwen.
So, Carrie Patterson's homesickness kit from 2013, which is like a small ball. Do you know that artwork? Yeah. And this kind of object, I think it's out of Battlestar Galactica or some other TV series. And you can open these little components and there are smells like sandalwood, linden blossom, rose and others. Apparently the smells most popular on planet Earth. And this is meant to come along when you travel space. So you have something to smell when you get homesick. But we learned this morning from Gwen that you cannot smell outer space. So the object is in itself pretty ridiculous, but also shows what I'm interested in this feelings. And also Gwen mentioned this empathy, this belonging and feelings of home we have via smell. As my research earlier showed that smell is, more connected to areas in our brain where we store our emotions. So I wonder when we earthlings are clinging to an object like that, that is also inclusive for all the earthlings, but also exclusive to the others. And that brings me to my project. which is actually not called Current Smells of Switzerland, but even worse, The Smell of Switzerland.
Hi, Dorothee.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on your EFK podcast.
Can you introduce us again to your research topic?
Yes. So I'm here at the ALFAC Symposium to speak about current smells of Switzerland as a way to introduce our dear smell community about my project, The Smell of Switzerland, which was funded by the Swiss National Fund with a Spark funding for the last year. And The Smell of Switzerland is about understanding mechanisms of inclusion and exclusion into what is called the Swiss community, and also understanding mechanisms of othering, so feeling of exclusion or a definite exclusion of the Swiss society. And that, of course, is a big adventure, as the Swiss society is very complex. It is shaped by a long history of migration and multilingual, with an ever-changing and fastly growing population. And thereby, I look at current media phenomena. So from TV ads to older books and movies, but also online communities. I went on to interview artists dealing also with smell and this question of what is it being Swiss.
Can you probably go back to your research about smell and language?
Yeah, so I was focusing on Swiss German, as Swiss German is with 50 somewhat percent like the most dominant spoken language, and also culturally, even though Italian and French and Romansh are official Swiss languages, the most prominent and dominant. So I'm also looking at language particularities, and in comparison to in Swiss German, they use the same word for taste and for smell, which is to schmecke. And I looked into that, and I also looked into proverbs dealing with smell. And there I found a lot of examples of othering, in the sense, coming back to this famous quote by Jonathan Reinertz, that kind of the loved ones smell well and the ones we don't know, they reek. There's a lot of distinction of kind of, okay, the stuff that is foreign to our nose doesn't smell well, and the local stuff smells good. So I find that a lot in the Swiss German proverbs as well. And I think that's a very interesting fact, that because also in the German language or in the English language or other languages, as far as I know, there's also positive comments, like we stopped to smell the roses, for example.
In her presentation, Dorothee elaborates on this. The smell of roses as an example for an olfactory picture in English that everyone knows.
So it's something positive. So you pause and take the beauty in of your environment or something. And here it's all about, I had the feeling the smell was all about othering. So when it smells, then if it stinks, something is rotten. Was stinkt, ist etwas faul, or schnufe lügt nicht. The nose doesn't lie. So also I can kind of separate between the good ones and the bad ones, my family and the others. Was gut schmeckt, geht ein gutes Gefühl. So you see, my Swiss German isn't that great. What smells good gives you a good feeling. Again, write the positive ones and the negative. Or not every scent is for every nose. Nicht jede Duft ist für jede Nase. I thought this very interesting, actually, to see that it's all actually all about the othering, all the things I found so far. If you have more, please send them to me.
Dorothee has collected many examples of the Swiss smell. It contains the smell of cheese, pine trees, fresh air, fruit. It comes with the fairy tale of the tradition.
But there is the swing, because Switzerland is so small and there are the mountains, that Switzerland cannot feed its inhabitants anymore, right? So it has to rely on importation anyways to feed all the people, especially when they want to eat organic. But this image of, okay, we eat the apple from the neighbor's garden or from our own garden, or yeah, I also grow up on a farm, is kind of repeated constantly. You don't count a Swiss unless, like, your great-grand-grand-grandfather was born there. It's all about the traditions and the memories. And I've also been interested in the memories and this positive connection and the empathy, but here it is kind of amplified to a level where I have some questions.
As far as I know, like, this idea of Switzerland is quite new, or selling this idea of Swiss country as some, like, a tourist destination or a good workplace, that came up with the idea of tourism in the late in the 19th century, and then this kind of brand of Switzerland also playing an important neutral role was then came to play after Second World War more and more, or starting with First World War. So I think also being, like, surrounded by countries of European Union, that there is, like, this big feeling of, okay, what is our identity? I think also, of course, it's like a big economic factor, this touristy images of the mountains, of the snow, of the perfect nature, of, like, wealth. And so I think this is catered to. And of course, that, so all the smelly, noisy, whatever things that don't fit into the picture have to be excluded. And I think that is kind of why. And also in current, like, in the last years, the population has grown very fast because the economy is growing fast. So there is a lot of people, especially coming from Germany, France, and Italy, but also other countries coming into Switzerland because there's a lot of work. But then there's also, I think, a fear that Swiss culture and tradition can be lost over time because it's so overpopulated by new people migrating to Switzerland.
Yesterday, after one of the talks, within a discussion, you proposed that there might be ways to overcome the othering through smell as well, because smell can also evoke feelings probably of empathy and warmth. And then today you've been speaking about your art project, yeah. Prompting. Can you elaborate on this?
Yeah, sure. So I've been doing a research on smell for quite a while. It's all started with my dissertation, Kunst riechen, smell art, like 10 or more years ago. And then from that, I got more and more interested in art projects that were dealing with smell, like Teresa Margol is an artist, for example, or Michael Pinsky, who also use smell to show, like, unjust situations or wealth disparity or also climate change disparity. And I felt like also in these art projects, there is a way that when we get so overwhelmed with a smell or take in the smell via breathing into our own body, then also reactions of empathy can happen. Like the where we process smells in our brain is very much connected where our emotions sit, like in the old parts of our brain, the amygdala and others. And there, so we have, like, strong emotional reactions to smells, like, oh, I like that, oh, I dislike that, oh, it smells like as if I was my grandmother's house or whatever. So I think we can also use these strong reactions to not only create disgust, but we could also, by either contextualizing it in a right way or also using familiar smells, create more atmospheres of empathy and trust and well-being. I don't know if that's so easy, of course. These are just, like, ideas, and I'm interested in art projects that deal with these questions. If, for example, today I was talking to Noah Wiese's work, Ode Glacier, about the melting glaciers, and I think we don't necessarily like the smell of this melting ice mixed with algae, But I think when we come to understand that it's about the glaciers and all the Swiss people, they love their glaciers for a good reason. We are very empathetic with the glaciers, and then we want to do something with them. So I think it is the smell on one side, but then, of course, it's also the narration around the smell that makes us feel empathetic.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So this was a few glimpses into the Olfax Symposium, organized by Silke Felber, Freda Fiala and Julia Ostwald in December 2025 at the IFK in Vienna. If you want to know more, please find them online at olfak.kunstuni-linz.at. This podcast is done by me, Katharina Rahn, with sound editing from Paul Jones. Thank you to everyone who spoke to us and to the wonderful team of the IFK. Auf Wiederhören.